Okay, so let's continue with the second part of the sutta. Now what we're going to do is we're going to go through these same terms again, and we're going to see the Buddha's explanation for each one of these. So the deity came, gave the riddle, and then said only the Buddha can answer this, and so Kassapa goes to see the Buddha and asks him about all of these things. And the Buddha gives his response, and I will just briefly, we've read through these before, and I'll just briefly go over them again and make sure that the explanation or the meaning is reasonably clear for each one of these. So the first one, the anthill, is a term for this body made up of the four primary elements produced by mother and father, built up from rice and porridge, liable to impermanence, to wearing away and erosion, to breaking up and destruction. So this is a stock phrase describing the body, and fairly self-explanatory, I think. And so this is like the Buddha's giving a very kind of direct and very straightforward reading of it. Okay, so he's just saying this anthill is a word for this body, right? But of course there are two things going on. Like in one way, the Buddha's giving a one-for-one explanation of the words that were given there. But also there's a lot which is left unsaid. Like, why is the anthill a metaphor for the body? Right? And that's something which is then up for us. That's up to our associations and connotations and responses. And, you know, in a sense, you can see, well, there is something to that, right? That the anthill is built up and it's a physical thing. It's made of all these different components and things like that. And so there's and it's also has that idea of being abandoned and falling apart, right? So the anthills we've seen, the anthills that the snakes live in are dead anthills, and so they are being eroded, right? So there's quite a lot of those kind of connotations which are similar in the way that those metaphors work. And one of my favorite writers on this subject was Julian Jaynes, and he talked about the role of metaphor in creating consciousness, and he divided metaphor into two parts. He said the metafire and the paraphire. Metafire and the paraphire. I'm not sure if I got the terminology right. Anyway, so he made up these terms for it. So basically when you have a metaphor, what happens is that you have like a specific thing that metaphor points to. So in this case, the anthill points to the body, right? And so that's pointing that one way like that. But there's also all of the other things which are unmentioned, the connotations and the evocations and the suggestions. So these are the paraphires. So whenever you're using a metaphor, the qualities of the initial thing, the metaphire, get carried over to the metaphrand, the thing which is made a metaphor of, but also the connotations get carried over as well, right? This is where the poetry comes in. So anybody can make a metaphor that's going to point to that thing, right? But the where the poetry and the evocation comes is where you point something that has some kind of unexpected, bring something unexpected along with it, which is going to inform it, it's going to enrich it. That's why a metaphor is something different than a label, it's something richer and more meaningful. When I, in the first of these classes, I made the distinction between a sign and a symbol. So essentially a sign exists in order to eliminate meaning, okay? So a sign exists in order to say there's a one-to-one relation between the sign and the thing. So that if we have the sign, for example, to Church Street, the whole point to having the sign on Church Street is that it's this street and not another street. Because when I want to go to the Buddha's library on 90 Church Street, I want to end up here and I don't want to end up somewhere else. That's why we make signs. Whereas symbols are very different. The purpose of a symbol is to amplify meaning, right? It's to create meaning. It's to expand the possibilities of meaning. And so this is what these paraphires do. So the paraphires bring along a bunch of connotations which are going to expand the possibilities of meaning. So in each of these explanations that the Buddha's giving, he's giving a one-to-one explanation to say this is what that means. But what he's leaving unsaid is also very rich. And so that leaves a lot of room for explanation and commentary and discussion and evocation and reflection. Okay, so the anthill. Second one, the fuming by night and flaming by day. So the fuming at night is thinking and considering all night about what you did during the day, and then the work you apply yourself to in the day by body, speech, and mind after thinking about it all night. Right? And I think it's a fairly familiar kind of scenario, right? And so you get home from work, and it's all night you're sort of lying in bed, can't get to sleep because you're thinking about all the things that happened during the day. And then by the time you get to work by the next day, you try to put into place all those things you thought about. And that kind of cycle or propulsion of thinking. And so this is, you know, one of the aspects and one of the dimensions of samsara, one of the dimensions of stress and suffering, right? It's very stressful because you can never stop. Right? And this is something that's very useful and very practical tip to remember, this particular imagery. And that idea, fuming by night, flaming by day, is a common imagery in Buddhist psychology. And it's derived ultimately from here, I believe. So that idea, what? Wow. Sorry. Sorry. Dana will understand this. See what it says here there, Dana? Kayena, Vachaya. These are instrumental forms, by body, by speech, by mind, right? Manasa, these are all instrumental forms. Manasa looks different. In fact, it's the same form, right? But this addition, they put quote marks around manasa, right? It's crazy. It's a bad mistake. Whoever edited that didn't understand the Pali text there. Shh, don't tell anybody. Okay. Sorry, I just noticed that. So what am I talking about? Fuming by night and flaming by day. Yeah. So as I've already mentioned before, that the idea of fuming by night, the unconscious, the darkness of those fumes and so on. In the daytime, it lights up and you go and do those things and have all of the energy. And we undo that by learning to focus in the present, right? And this is something which is a kind of a mistake that a lot of meditators make, is that they think that the work that they do is something they have to get out of the way so that you can go home and meditate, right? And this is just sort of repeating that cycle. It's reinforcing that cycle. How what you do is, when you're working, you have to focus on your work and focus 100% on your work and all of those kinds of things. And then when you leave, even just to make like a determination in your mind just to close those things down and don't do them, right? So like even when I'm working, you know, when I finish my work for the day, I shut off any emails, notifications, anything like that. You consciously do it. That's my work for the day finished. That's it. And then you learn to be able to shut those things down. And so just make those conscious boundaries so that your work is left behind in the day, and then the nighttime is not fuming by night. Okay, so, and again, you know, you can see that this like has a specific meaning, like a sign, but it also has, you know, quite a lot of connotations. You know, it's a very rich set of imagery there. So the word Brahman is a term for the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. This, of course, is a common revaluation of the term Brahman. Traditionally, the term Brahman was a word for the member of the Brahman caste. But the members of the Brahman caste claimed that they were Brahmins because they were the highest of God, right? That they were the appointed of God. But the Buddha said, well, actually, it's how you live which makes you a Brahman. And especially one who's free from defilements is a Brahman. So the highest meaning of Brahman is for the Buddha himself. So a sage here, Sumedha, is a term for the trainee mendicant. Okay? So sage, the actual term here is Sumedha. So literally a wise one or a very, very intelligent one, something like that. One of the problems in Pali is that there are much too many words for wisdom and cleverness and intelligence. Sumedha and Muni and Pandita and Panyava, and oh, there's so many of them. So we end up reusing terms quite a lot. So the trainee mendicant, so a trainee is somebody who's already asked by Nicola earlier. Trainee is a technical term which is usually used for somebody who's on one of the eight paths and fruits to Nibbana. So one on the path to stream entry or a stream enterer and so on. And so anyone who's on those paths is a trainee, except for, of course, the arahant, who is the aseka, the one who's beyond training or who's adept. Yes.
So,
yes. Right. Yeah. Right.
From what I see there, three would be applied to.
Could it? Yeah, it doesn't really specify their age, but yeah, I get your point. Yeah, it's certainly talking about somebody who's in training rather than someone who's at that point. Yeah, yeah, it's true. Normally I use sage to translate muni, where it usually actually does mean an arahant, someone who's fully enlightened. So, but again, it's one of those things that English is a bit short of words. So I'm not sure what else I would use, sage or a intelligent one, a smart guy. And probably it's interesting in English, like most of the words we have for like intelligence and so on are quite degraded, right? So, you know, you have a word like wit, which actually originally means like wisdom. It's the same root as wisdom, but wit is a kind of, you say, well, a witty guy, a smart guy, a clever person, a wise guy, right? Even wise guy. Yeah. So anyway, suggestions are welcome. Right. It's a name, yeah, yeah. So, but here it says it's a term for the trainee. So, but yeah. I mean, it's a slightly unusual. Like Sumedha is a slightly poetic term, right? If the Buddha's normally talking about someone like this, he wouldn't use the word Sumedha. So itself, it's a poetic term, and there's probably some connotation there that it has. Maybe there's like a Vedic usage or something like that, like why that particular term is used in that place. But I'm not 100% sure on that one. Yeah. So sword is a term for noble wisdom. So remember, we've been told to dig with the sword, right? So to you know, like a getting loosening the soil, getting rid of it and so on. So so the idea of sword as a wisdom is quite a classical idea. Right, we have Manjushri and his flaming sword of wisdom and these kinds of things. This is probably one of the earlier uses of that. I'm not sure if there are any earlier uses, but it's certainly one of the early uses. And the idea is that you can cut through illusion and cut through confusion and so on. So digging is a term for being energetic. So it's using this all the way through. So remember, dig with the sword. Right, constantly the refrain throughout the whole thing, dig with the sword, O wise one, dig with the sword, O wise one. So this is what it's saying, keep on practicing, keep on going, keep putting an effort in. But one of the things that's interesting about this, though, is that just again, think in terms of those metaphors and paraphors, like normally when we talk about the spiritual path, we use a metaphor of the path, right? In fact, we use it so often we forget that it's a metaphor, but right, that's a metaphor as a path. Or we use like ascending imagery to talk about it, right? So you're sort of going up or going, you know, you're going up through different stages or something like that. But here it's using it's digging down, the metaphor of digging down, which is why one of the reasons why it seems a lot like the kind of modern psychological idea of sort of digging down the layers into the unconscious, right? Again, just important to remember that these are all metaphors. None of them are real, right? There's no such thing as digging down into layers of the unconscious, right? It's just a way of talking about the mind, right? There's no such thing as a spiritual path, right? It's just a way of talking about things. So these are metaphors that are supposed to evoke some kind of response. And, you know, to use metaphors flexibly shows that it avoids essentializing them. So just remember that we can apply these metaphors in all kinds of different and flexible ways. That's part of the creativity of the Buddha, that he wasn't sort of stuck on just one way of talking about things. So the word langi or bar, I've translated, remember, bar is a bit obscure in its meaning, so I'm not exactly sure what it means, but it's something that seems to mean throw out ignorance, right? So ignorance is that which is stopping you, like a bar that's standing in your way. So this next one is an interesting one. Bullfrog is a term for anger and distress. Throw out the bullfrog means give up anger and distress. Why is that, I wonder? Why is the bullfrog an image for anger and distress? We already saw before that the bullfrog's associated in the Vedas with that kind of imagery, and it didn't seem to be associated with anger there. Actually, it seemed to have these very nice imagery around it, right? So here the Buddha's revaluing it. Why is a bullfrog associated with anger? I mean, maybe he's talking about cane toads. That would be very understandable, right? Talking puffed up is an interesting part of it, right? Because it has uddha, which is similar to the one of the hindrances, is uddhacha, right? Restlessness, right? And it has that idea of uddha, does have, that's what that puffed up mean, right? So, and it is actually associated with that. So there's actually terms in Pali, uddhata, which you can translate either as like conceited, puffed up, or angry, or these kinds of things, right? So this is kind of the bullfrog is like, stop. That makes sense? Yeah. Right? And bullfrogs can be, yeah? So the Buddha's definitely giving more of like if you went back to the Vedas and you look at the Vedas, Vedas are very beautiful because they're very Vedas is like the kind of this kind of bright sunshine, like everything's wonderful and everything's divine and everything's like, you know, the great hero who overcomes the darkness and it's this kind of really almost like naive purity in that kind of worldview that it's presenting, right? It's like the youth of civilization, that's all things are possible and it doesn't know anything about age and death and all of those kinds of things. And the Buddha is sort of giving us a much more sort of darker perspective on things, yeah? So, interesting. Okay, so... Right. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that, you know, they're not obviously, they know that there's such a thing as aging and death, but the emphasis in them, yeah, it's really kind of, it's just joyous, this simple joy of life, you know, that's being celebrated again and again there. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they're songs of the victors, right? I mean, the Aryans were the victors. They were the ones who mastered the horse and chariot and who went over half the world and destroyed everybody and put their culture everyone. These are their victory songs of the winners, right? And they were filled with this sense of the power of and rightness of what they were doing. Okay, so forked path. Is a term for doubt. Throw out the forked path means give up doubt. I guess when Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as fork rather than forked path, I guess it's because, you know, you've got to throw it out. It seems a bit hard to throw out a forked path, easy to throw out a fork. So it's understandable, but yeah. In any case, it's a, you know, again, it's a fairly obvious synonym for doubt, and the fact that it's obvious means it's a bit boring. Huh? Not too much to say about it. Box is a term for the five hindrances, that is the hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse and doubt. So notice here the restlessness, uddhacca. Yeah, so it's the same root as the uddhumayika, uddhu there. It's actually the same root, sort of puffed up restlessness. So... I mentioned before, and just to sort of clarify what I was saying before, that the word nivarana, the literal meaning of the word nivarana is an obstruction, right? Something that stands in the way of something. But it's commonly used in the imagery around it is used in the sense of like a shroud, right? So a nivarana is something that wraps and obstructs your view, obstructs your sight, right? Not so much obstructing your journey, but obstructing your sight, your vision, what you can know. And the word nivarana, as with so many of these, is ultimately derived from the Vedas. And in the Vedas, the nivarana is vritra. Vritra, the dragon, right? And Vritra is the big bad of the Rig Vedas, okay? He's the fundamental foe who is overcome. And the songs of the Rig Vedas constantly singing of Indra, the mighty hero who has vanquished Vritra. And this is a story which is so well known and so fundamental that they don't bother telling it. I mean, it's told a few times fairly briefly in the Rig Vedas, but there's no like long story that's telling of Indra and his thing. It was so well known in the culture that these are songs celebrating the victory that everybody knows about, right? And this is Indra, the sky god, the warrior god, overcoming Vritra, the god of darkness, the serpent. And Vritra was one who would wrap his coils around, yeah, encompassing you and smothering you and crushing out the light. Yeah. So this is where that root of nivarana comes from, and the why it's associated with those ideas of darkness and ignorance and so on. So this is why I thought that box, remembering again that box is a problematic and dubious translation. We don't really know what Changavara is. Again, here it says milk strainer. But I think it means a box because it's hindering. Yeah. Right? Sounds evocative, right? Sounds, yeah, calls up a similar connotation. Yeah. Remembering, of course, that a box is a technological innovation, right? I mean, we think a box is just something that you have. But boxes are quite hard to make, right? I mean, you know, you make them out of paper, right? But to make a solid box, that it means you have something precious to keep inside. Okay, throughout the box. Tortoise. So tortoise is a term for the five grasping aggregates, form, feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness. Of course, the five grasping aggregates, Panchupadana Kanda, one of the most common teaching categories in the suttas, as indeed is the five hindrances. And so the five grasping aggregates are one of the Buddha's fundamental analyses of life, of what this is. The fact that there's five of them, like the five fingers, is also a bit like a tortoise, right? The four legs and its head, right? And the tortoise has that idea of like age, but it has also that idea, like it carries its house around on its back, right? So with the grasping aggregates, you have to carry your aggregates around with you. Like there's a sort of the bara have panchakanda, the five khandas are the burden. Right? So the khandhas are this burden which we've taken up from our past karma. This is what the grasping aggregates means, or one of the meanings of it, our past karma. We've taken up these aggregates and we then have to carry them around as our life. Yeah? Like the tortoise. Yeah? Having to carry it around. And that's why we're so kind of slow and, oh. Yeah? And you know, that kind of imagery that the Buddha's always like, you know, be like a bird, yeah? Just be as light as a bird, be content, don't have many things. Don't be like the tortoise. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because there's this kind of mythological thing of tortoise is like holding up the world, right? So I'm not that familiar with Chinese mythology, so I can't say much, but it seems to be something like that, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, sometimes in Indian mythology, they have like the elephants that are holding up the world. Something's got to hold the world up, right? It can't just float there in the middle of space. I mean, it would just fall down. It would just fall down, which, of course, is what it does, right? Okay, so throw out the tortoise. Axe and block is a term for the five kinds of sensual stimulation, sights known by the eye, sounds known by the ear, and so on and so forth. So the idea here is that the axe and then a block, chomp, 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 and this is what our senses are like, because the external sense is like the axe, and then the internal sense, the eye or whatever, is like the block, and then the stimulation comes and it's like boom, boom, boom. So we're being bombarded with this stimulation, right? And so this is why it's so overwhelming. And so, you know, we think these things that we think are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, right? But actually, it's this constant bombardment, like being chopped. Yeah. Okay, so lump of meat, monks of Percy, is a term of desire with relishing, nandi raga. And so it means to give that up. And so... monks are Percy. What's the sense of the metaphor here? Why is this particular metaphor being used? Eating, something to do with eating, desire for eating. Right. Lump of mage. I wonder. Sorry? Nutriment, sustenance. Anyone got any other ideas? I'm not sure, to be honest. I guess so, although... why that specifically, right? I mean, there's many things that we could say are, you know, a symbol for seeking desire or gratification. It's not one that's commonly used, right? A lump of meat. I mean, I guess to some people a lump of meat is delicious or whatever. Right. It's craving, yeah. But again, I don't find it really satisfying. Yes, obviously it does mean that, but why a lump of meat and not something else? Yeah. Monks of Percy, sorry? Monks of Percy, yeah. Yeah. It's used, I tell you why actually. It's used in the there's another place where there's a series of similes for sensual pleasures. Thank you. Patalia Sutta? And there's a whole kind of series of them, and one of them is like a lump of flesh. And it's in the simile is given like some birds, like some vultures or something, who like are fighting with each other over this lump of meat, right? So they're all kind of getting it, and so I think, yeah, it must be referring to that. Yeah. Right. The desire to have that, and of course it's limited. It's like a little piece of flesh, and we're always fighting over just that little limited piece of thing, and we think that it's so tasty and so everything, but it causes all of that conflict and all of those things. Yeah. Yep. Yep. It's something I'm sure people want it. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what they... Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is anyone getting hungry by now? Yeah. I mean, by metaphor, yes, but it's not directly stating that. Yes, I mean, our body is stated right at the beginning with the anthill. So, yeah. Right. Right. right? Right. Nah, yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah, you kind of like, if you've been vegetarian for a long time, it's like meat is like, and like the smell of it and stuff, yeah. Yeah. Yes, certainly there's no, yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no kind of real. I mean, some of the monks were vegetarian, some were not. So yeah. Vegetarianism as a kind of standard practice in the Mahayana traditions. Yes, that came in later, but I mean, there would have been some monks who were vegetarian at the time. So the Buddha said it's a personal preference. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, the very fact that he says it's personal preference means there must have been some monks who were vegetarian. Yeah. Controversial, yeah, controversial. The primary sutta that discusses that is the Jivaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, where Jivaka heard this from the Jains. So the Jains were criticizing the Buddhists for not being vegetarian. And the sort of fundamental tenets of Jainism would seem to imply that you have to be vegetarian, because they say that, you know, even without intention, if you're causing the death of an animal, then you're still morally liable for it. Right? So it seemed logical that they'd be vegetarian. In fact, it seems a bit more problematic than that, as religion and history usually is. And so historically, it seems probably some Jain sects were vegetarian and others were not. Yeah. Right. Well, I would hope so, but apparently not. That's not how the traditions have usually interpreted it. Yeah. The usual interpretation is if the meat has already been killed, then you're good to go. Num, num, num. But I mean, it's very problematic, and it's especially, you know, something that, because I've been vegetarian my whole life, right? I became vegetarian when I was 18, and since I'm old enough to know for myself. And, you know, something that was especially obvious to me in Malaysia, because in Malaysia you have, you know, most of the Buddhists in Malaysia are from a Chinese background, and they have their traditional Buddhist background is obviously Chinese Buddhism, which is Mahayanist. And in Mahayana, for religious purposes, they're always vegetarian, right? So the monasteries are vegetarian, and whenever they do any religious ceremonies and so on, then they're always vegetarian. It doesn't mean the people themselves are vegetarian, but when they did, you know, they may or may not be, but when they did their religious services, they certainly are. And they're very strong on that, right? It's you know, quite outrageous to be eating meat in those kinds of settings, right? But then, of course, modern Theravada comes along, and the Theravada monks from Sri Lanka, and especially Burma, and especially Thailand. Actually, you know, Sri Lankan temples and things, you know, they don't have much meat. Maybe have a bit of fish or a bit of meat now and then, but not that much. But in Thailand, there's a lot, like a lot. Like, I've been in a meal where they're serving like 100 dishes, and all I could have was some rice and a garnish. Like, everything else was just meat. Yeah. So there's a lot. So what I saw in Malaysia was that the families that were Mahayanist would be vegetarian, and if they became Theravadan, they would start eating meat because of that. Right? It wasn't just that Theravada was accepting to people eat meat, it was actively encouraging and promoting meat eating in the culture. And so I think this is something that we should be taking a stronger stand on. And you know, I certainly you know, for myself, being vegetarian my whole life, and encourage that for everyone in Sangha and in Dhamma circles. And yeah, I mean, I could go on for a long time, but one important thing about that is that the situation with meat eating has changed very drastically since the time of the Buddha. I mean, obviously the basic situation of killing animals is the same, but the environmental impacts of it, the economic impacts and so on, is so much different than in the time of the Buddha. So in those days, you know, you have some chickens which are squawking around the farmyard or something like that, and then you kill one for the meal, and it's actually just a normal part of the ecosystem. Whereas today we have these horrifying, like now in China they have these like multi-story pig farms, like high-rise pig farms with facial recognition for the pigs, right? So you do facial recognition so you can tell which ones are getting sick because they're spreading all these diseases, because you shouldn't really be raising pigs in multi-story high-rise. And yeah, it's just pretty, the whole thing's pretty horrifying. So, yeah. Right. And the females, you had the eggs, yeah. Right. And that's also part of the seasons, right? Because you, in the cold climates, you don't have much in vegetables and fruit and things at winter, yeah. And the amount of meat eating is growing very, very fast. Yeah. Oh, also, yeah, that's quite right, yeah. Yeah. Like a cleaver. Maybe you should translate that as cleaver, asi suna. I'll look that up, but yeah, maybe it's like a cleaver, like chopping the... yeah. That's a common simile, like you find that all through the Theragata guitar and the Axum block. Yeah. Yes, in many cases, like this one, the lump of meat, yes, that one with the axe and block, yes. Others, tortoise, I'd have to check, not so much, maybe. So some of them are a bit more obscure, but some of them are used quite commonly. Yeah. And then, of course, the dragon. And, of course, as we mentioned, the naga having those many different meanings. And leaving the dragon behind, so leaving the literally a snake in those snake anthills, but also having the meaning of a supernatural serpent. So I usually translate it as dragon when I'm translating. See, I'm using the word supernatural now after just telling you that it's not an appropriate word to use, so I'm very bad. But in Buddhism, it's not, the word supernatural doesn't really fit in Buddhism. So the word supernatural means like literally above nature, right? Supernatural, above nature. And it comes from like a Christian or Western mythology where God creates the world, but God is outside of the world. So there's a one-way causality. God acts on the world, but the world doesn't act on God. So God can essentially supervene and do whatever he wants, right? This is the underlying sense of the word supernatural. Whereas in Buddhism, and actually for Eastern religions generally, these things are all part of nature. Right, devas and nagas and things like that. I mean, whether you could think that they exist or that they're real or not is another question. But they're always considered to be part of nature, and they're working together with the natural laws. So, this idea of the naga is like just basically a powerful being. The leaving the dragon, as I mentioned before, has that, I think, very important spiritual and psychological significance of leaving those or incorporating those aspects of the older religiosity into the new one rather than getting rid of it. And I think there's like an important lesson there to sort of speak to something about the practical way of looking at it, because I think in modern times, and one of the reasons why I'm trying to emphasize these metaphorical and mythological dimensions of suttas, we there's a strong tendency to over secularize, over psychologize, over rationalize our traditions. And by doing so, we lose a lot. Right? There's a whole bunch of connotations, a whole richness, a whole earthiness, a whole mess that comes along with that tradition, which is a part of a lived reality and a lived experience of a religious path. And you know, just mentioned that we were last night at the iftar celebration, the breaking of the fast for Ramadan at the community, Muslim community in northwestern Sydney. And of course, it was a little bit difficult for us because we're not allowed to eat after noon, right? And so everyone's breaking their fast and we couldn't eat anything. But apart from that, it was very interesting to see that living religious tradition, you know, and just those little details that you see, like when they did the first call for prayer and the MC was there and he said, you know, does anyone want to do the call for prayer? He says in a very Aussie accent, anyone want to do the call for prayer, mate? And and he says, oh, well, I guess I'll have to do it then. And so then he does the call for prayer, you know, and that kind of humor and humanity in the community is something you don't get by just reading about religious doctrines. And that kind of idea that we can somehow reduce our religious traditions to some kind of set of philosophies and principles and practices and then kind of reconstitute it, we lose a lot in the process, you know, and there's a lot which is passed down in the traditions through body language, through shared assumptions, through norms of polite behavior, through the way that imagery is used, and all of these kinds of things. So I'm not saying that in our modern times we have to just adopt all those things wholesale, but I am saying that it's worthwhile to take an interest in them and to respect them and to pay attention to them, because they represent a way of responding to a religious or spiritual teaching, which is something that we can learn from. So far we've looked at all of these kinds of imagery and we've considered different aspects of it. We've considered the literal, I've looked a little bit at the historical background, I've looked a little bit at the terminology and so on. We've looked to some degree at the moral implications, and we've seen that the Buddha especially was concerned to point to practical implications of these teachings, and so that they embodied a certain practice. We've also looked that, we haven't gone into this in too much detail, but if you sort of step back from it a little bit, then you can see that the course of the metaphors does sort of represent a path, and I think Nicola mentioned this a little bit earlier. So we're beginning the path by taking up the sword, the anthill fuming by day and flaming by fuming by night and flaming by day is our suffering and our stress and so on. We're beginning the path. We see the various things that are obstacles in the path, the bar and the bullfrog and so on, the forked path, right? So this is a very crucial moment in our spiritual practice. We go one way or the other. We encounter the hindrances and so on. Then abandoning the hindrances, we go deeper, abandon the sensual world, and then seeing the aggregates and so on. So it is actually following that spiritual path in quite a nice way. But that's, again, it's implicit. It's not, the Buddha's not stating this as such, but it's sort of suggesting that as we're going along. One interesting little detail is the role of the sword. And I haven't talked about that too much. I mentioned before that the sword has this... it's the metaphor is for wisdom, and it's associated with action, right? So it's what you do with that sword, right, to cut things with. But sword also has a very specific and very rich set of mythical connotations. And if you remember, the most powerful and most famous imagery of the sword is where King Arthur will draw the sword from the stone, right? And drawing the sword from the stone is one of the classical mythical images. Why? Because it represents mining, right? That's what the sword from the stone represents, mining. We make swords from stones, literally, yeah? So mythology isn't just up in the sky. It's not just sets of ideas. It's associated with specific technologies and specific times and places. The idea of a sword wouldn't have made sense a few thousand years before the Buddha. They didn't have swords. They didn't have mining. In fact, iron smelting only happened fairly shortly before the Buddha. So this is a technological idea, right? And so, but the idea again has that kind of similar thing that within the earth, right, within the ground. I mean, the ground is just dirt, right? It's just there. There's a lot of it, and it's not very valuable, right? Or it doesn't seem very valuable. But within that, there are these treasures which are imminent within the soil. They're always there. They've always been there. And when we traveled out to Central Australia recently, you can see that the whole of Australia is red, right? It's iron everywhere, and it's just there in the soil. And so by applying heat, yeah, by applying the appropriate technologies and by working, then we can extract that sword from that soil. So we can create something that's very valuable out of something that's quite cheap and quite widely available. But that work and that effort is in there to create that sword. Yeah? And a sword, of course, in those days, I mean, even today, really, but the sword in those days was something that's very rare, very precious, very valuable, right? It's only kings and the knights and so on who had swords. It wasn't just something you had lying around the place. So he's extracting the sword. The sage, like King Arthur, is pulling the sword from the stone, and then that's what he uses for doing his work. And so that sword, because it's bright and it's flashing, right? It's bright. It's, you've turned dark, dull soil into bright, shiny metal. Right? This is why it's the brightness of wisdom, the brightness of the intellect, the brightness of understanding, which is slashing through the darkness. And so each of these images has these kind of multiple layers which we can draw on. And in the mythology, then we can look at the historical grounds of it. We can look at the religious parallels of it. We can look at the psychological dimensions of it. We can look at the linguistic dimensions and so on and so forth. And none of these dimensions are going to exhaust the meaning. And we've seen, as I was saying before, we've seen something of the literal meaning of these things. We've seen something of the practical applications of it. We've seen something of the metaphorical ideas here, the way that the simple, straightforward ideas are then applied in new and creative ways, and in ways especially that evoke some kind of response. And this is really the critical thing, that metaphors demand some kind of creative response. It's not just handed to you on a platter. Right, and if all the teachings are handed to you on a platter, you never learn, because you don't make those connections yourself. Wisdom comes when the answer comes from inside you, not from when someone gives you all the answers. Right? And then finally, we have the transcendent level. So these suttas always point to a transcendent level, almost always. Like the last term in the suttas, the last sentence is pointing towards Nibbana, and here Nibbana is represented by the dragon, which is the perfected one. And so this is pointing towards that transcendence. And so that whole sutta is presenting that transcendent truth as that descent through those layers in the anthill, a descent towards deeper and deeper levels of the unconscious. And people talk about like parallels between Buddhism and psychology and so on. But to me, this is probably the most fundamental level of similarity between Buddhism and psychology, as that Freud talked about the unconscious, that of which we do not know. And this is quite a new way of thinking about things from a Western perspective. From a Western perspective, the mind was always what was present in consciousness. And the idea that there would be things which were in the mind which you didn't know about, but which were fundamentally conditioning you, this was quite a new idea. But that unconscious, of course, is very similar, very parallel to the idea of avidya in Buddhism, ignorance. It's basically the same kind of idea, that there are things in the mind, forces in the mind that we don't know about, that are creating the suffering and the stress that we're experiencing. And so that journey into the unconscious, that journey towards avidya with the bright sword of wisdom, is that which can bring to light that which lurks in the darkness and which creates suffering. So these are my few thoughts and reflections for you on the Vamika Sutta, looking at it from these four different angles and trying to share some of the dimensions of the mythology, the symbolism, the practical applications, and the historical background of this teaching. So I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite, we have a few minutes left, if anybody has any questions or something, please, most welcome. Venerable sir. Thank you. Right. Does seem a bit strange, yeah. Not exactly sure. Maybe it's like an idiom or not exactly sure. Bringing it up to bring up to light, yeah. But I'm not sure, yeah. Maybe. What? Tell us more. Tell us more. Yeah. Maybe, yeah. Does sound pretty kind of dramatic, doesn't it? Yeah. Just to pick up on what you just said there, just because people might be a bit confused just by that kind of throwaway line, you said don't make them apply to yourself. What I mean by that, what I'm talking about, is the difference between the literal and the moral. That when people read suttas, very often they rush to that second aspect, say, well, how do I practically apply this, without spending the time to figure out what's it really talking about. And so it's not saying that we shouldn't look at the suttas and apply them practically, but it's just saying, you know, take your time about it. Don't be in too much of a rush. Just what is it exactly saying? And so in this case, yes, to ask, what are they saying to Kassapa? And that's an interesting picture that you've painted of him. And you know, to me, like when you see that, and if you see these few, we have like a points. It's a bit like what were those drawings by that guy with the big nose and the pencil on his nose? Mr. Squiggle, yeah, right? It's a bit like a Mr. Squiggle, right? So we've got these few points on a board, and then we can draw our picture. And so, you know, I think that's a great opportunity for creativity, like, you know, through painting or arts or storytelling or something, to actually paint those pictures of these people, yeah. And? Yes. Swords are always bright and shining. Yeah, it would burst into flame if it was down there, pretty sure. Yeah. that's exactly right, yeah. It is, like, it's a great little metaphor there, yeah. But that's why the lightsaber works, right? Because the flashing swords are like that, yeah. Thank you. Okay. Okay.
Which is completely, if at any time there is at any lesson, that you truly have to be in a state of peace.
Okay, any last questions before we wrap up? We shouldn't be too long because the our good volunteers are wanting to go home and have a Sunday lump of flesh or veggies, whatever they're having. Anyway, so let's wrap up if there's no urgent questions. Thank you so much for your presence and for your attention during this class. And we will be back for one final talk in this series in a month's time. So hopefully I will see you all back here. Meanwhile, on this Tuesday week, I'll be back here at the Buddhist Library for a course on Buddhist mythology. So we touched on mythology a little bit today. And so this will be a four-week course. And if you want to come, I would certainly encourage you to come to all 4 weeks if you can. Sorry, all four sessions, rather than the sutta session, which is once a month for four sessions over once a month. This is four sessions once a week. So we're just playing with different formats to see what's going to work, right? And but this is a structured course over 4 weeks, which will look at mythology and how it connects with Buddhism. The first one will be on a general talk about an introduction to mythology, and then we'll draw out different aspects of it over the 4 weeks. So if you're interested in some of the ideas that I've talked about today, then please do come along for that course on Buddhism and mythology. Meanwhile, I will also be at the Metta Center, Tina's Metta Center in Bankstown on Tuesday night. So please come along for that if you're in the area. And any other events you would like to mention, please.